Be seated. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Let's see. This, the first argued case is number 20-1415 BASF Plant Science against Commonwealth Scientific. It doesn't say which counsel is speaking first. Ms. Stetson? All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Kate Stetson. I am representing BASF and Cargill in this argument, except for the venue issue, which Mr. Davis will argue separately. This case is two cross appeals arising from a judgment on a series of different patents. BASF's appeal involves two issues, written description and ownership. So just to start with written description. Written description, of course, requires that an inventor at the time of the specification, which here was 2004, show that he actually possessed the invention of which he spoke. The reason for that, of course, as this Court said in Amgen, is to prevent an applicant from later asserting that he invented something that he did not. Here, the claim that eventually was published claims a canola plant or any plant that makes EPA and DHA, the long-chain fatty acids, using a particular pathway. The problem that the patent holder runs into with respect to written description is that the reference to canola comes up two or three times in the course of this many, many page patent. And it comes up in laundry lists of plants that may be available for the similar pathway process.
It doesn't quite just come up, right? It's the lead member, isn't it, of the preferred group? Is that right?
No, I don't think that it's even described as the lead member of the preferred
group. Isn't it the first
group,
the first listed member of the preferred group?
It is one of the first listed members of a 4,000 plant group. That's right. But you know, the presence of it in the list, along with things like pineapple and alfalfa and coffee and peanuts, really doesn't say much about whether the invention is directed to the canola plant. So just to take an example.
Right, and then we have consistently held, right, that we don't just look at the spec by itself. This is a fact question, and so evidence counts, and there was a significant amount of evidence, was there not, that if you could do this in the Arabidopsis, then which everybody understands to be a test plant, in particular for canola, then you could do it in canola. You may not be able to do it in commercial quantities. You may not be able to do it, may not be know what the very best way of doing it is, but you could do it. Why isn't that enough for?
So I have to uphold
a jury verdict on a fact question.
I have to. If there were, in fact, significant evidence that you could do it in Arabidopsis, then the answer is yes. The issue is there's not significant evidence of this at all. In fact, the evidence in the record is exactly the type of evidence that this court found ineffective in the Centacor case. This is a case which Cicero, in its brief, doesn't address, but it reversed the judge's denial of a JMOL after a jury verdict. And in that case, the inventor had testified something almost eerily similar to what the expert, the single witness here, testified, which is if you have it in Arabidopsis, you have it in canola. There, it was a question about mouse human chimeric antibodies. And the question there was, did the patent specification claim human antibodies? And what the inventor there had said was, if you have it in mice, you have it in humans. But the issue was the specification in that case only was, and I'm quoting, sprinkled with a few references throughout to the fact that there were human antibodies. That was found insufficient to constitute a fulsome written description that included the scope of a human antibody in that case. That is exactly this case. So when we talk about significant evidence, I would actually encourage you to look at the evidence that is cited, because what it boils down to is one witness, the expert for Cicero, saying a few different times, if you have it in Arabidopsis, you have it in canola. And that, of course, is not, we say, sufficient, particularly when you have so much evidence that says these two plants for this invention are very different. They have different profiles. They are used different ways.
Can you tell me, thinking about the evidence of from your expert, if I were looking at that evidence with the following question constantly in mind, is he talking about commercial levels of production, or is he talking about all that the claim requires, which is just getting some oil out of it? What would I find? Does he ever say, you know, you really might not get oil at all, big unknown?
Well, I think that there is a reference, and I think it's Cicero's expert, Dr. Singh, that talks about the, you know, the time that it took Cicero to develop this in canola, having to do with commercialization. Of course, that's belied by the record. There are multiple sites in the record to the fact that the sponsor of these projects in 2009, 2010 was saying things like, this proof of concept has not been yet shown in canola. This works in Arabidopsis, but not canola. That's 13479 of the joint appendix. Weakness in project, failed to achieve proof of concept in canola, A13615. So this isn't even a case where you have just the four corners of the specification, which is the usual thing that you examine with written description. You actually have multiple references by the people who are sponsoring these projects that they haven't yet gotten it to work. And so when you post that up against all of the sprinkling, as this court used in the Centacor, of references to canola in that long, detailed invention of how to get this process to work in Arabidopsis, you have a problem. And let me point you to a couple other cases that were not responded to in Cicero's brief, because I think the cases to which Cicero chose not to respond are actually the pivotal cases in this brief. I've mentioned Centacor already. One of the other ones I'd mentioned is this court's en banc opinion in Ariad. It was exactly, again, the same posture as this case, a reversal of a judge's denial of Jamal after a jury verdict. And what this court concluded, among other things, was that even where the specification in that case described the molecules that were later claimed, what the specification didn't do was to disclose, and I'll quote here, how the claimed reduction, that was a reduction in immune response, was to be achieved, and provide a descriptive link between what was claimed and that response, that process. That is exactly what we're saying is missing in this case. You can't just mention canola in a laundry list of literally three dozen other things, even if it takes pole position in the top of that list, and declare that you have possession of the invention in canola. That's what Ariad precisely says you can't do. And Cicero offered no response to it in its brief.
Can I just ask this? On the assumption that we were to disagree with you about the canola-specific claims, I don't see an argument in your brief that we should nevertheless strike down the very broad claims that are not limited to canola and related. I mean, I guess, am I right about that?
I know that we argued with respect to both.
I thought only together. Presumably because everybody cares about is canola. But I didn't see an argument separately about the broader claims.
I don't think we made a lesser included argument that if you don't agree with us on canola, then these particular
and
claims.
Was there testimony below from your expert to the effect that, well, even if canola is sufficiently described, the rest of what's in the very broad claims is not?
You know, that hasn't been a focus of the party's briefing, either below or here. I think in part because some of the claims that include all plants are also claims that reflect on the canola patent as well. So there's some overlap among those four patents. But I think the issue with all plants, of course, is that you can claim that you invented something, but this shows you that the specification shows you simply that Dr. Singh in 2004 did not possess the thing that he was claiming. In fact, it took him until after the collaboration with BASF in order to actually get the process to work in canola, and we think that timeline is telling. Let me speak briefly to the ownership issues, because I'm sensitive to getting into my rebuttal time. The jury found that BASF co-owned the Group B patent. That finding was correct. It's very clear from the record that elements of BASF's genes found their way into the patent as joint results from the collaboration.
Why is that enough under the language? I would have thought that when you talk about intellectual property, you're talking about, for the case of invention, we're not talking about trade secrets here or anything, that you got to identify what the intellectual property is. The intellectual property here is what's claimed. Lots of new inventions have components that are old. And I would have thought that the question for the ownership agreement would be whether this intellectual property is covered by the agreement, not just that components of the new claim reflect that.
But yet that's exactly what the agreement says, is that joint results that are incorporated into a patent are owned. And I'm looking in particular at Appendix 12682 to 84. This is at the end of the MTEA, the Materials Transfer and Evaluation Agreement. And one of the things that those pages do is to point out a number of different shared constructs that include BASF's genes. And those genes, as we point out in our briefs, with respect to both Group B, which Cicero is challenging, and two patents in Group A, found their way into the patent. Those are joint results that are incorporated into the patent. So under the terms of this agreement,
and
they
so
are
which page were you referencing again?
This is A12682 to 84. I think it's the end of
right
volume 7.
These are the 13 constructs
yes.
identified.
Yes, and 12 of the 13
and,
have a BASF.
And are the patent B claims directed to any of these 13 constructs? I thought it was a different construct.
The patent B claims incorporate genes that are used in these constructs. The
but,
combinations
but the
of con- genes.
Any individual construct that's identified in this agreement is not present in the claims. Is that fair to say?
I don't know that that's fair
you're,
to
you're,
say.
You're telling me that there's some overlap between elements in these constructs and elements that are recited in the patent B claims.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, precisely
but,
because.
But none of these constructs are encompassed by any of the patent B claims. Is that fair to say?
I think what is encompassed
none
by
None of
the
these
claims,
constructs would infringe any of these patent B claims
none
or
of
anticipate
these,
if it was prior.
None of the joint constructs, but I think the issue is those joint constructs gave mm-hmm. rise to the kind of sequences that are shown in the patent, including the BASF gene that was claimed. So under the language of the agreement, I think it's very clear that these are joint results that are incorporated into the patent. That's the language of the jury
instruction. But how do we know that? How do we know that the joint results of these the work on these 13 constructs materialized in the patent B claims?
Because you can see it at Joint Appendix 1934 and 2040. Which are the 792 patent, for example, that claims...
The claims these include some of BASF's genes.
Correct.
But those were already known in the public, right?
Yes, but the work that was done in the construct, you know, this was not just sort of identifying some pathway to make this work in plants. This was
Is
identifying...
there some kind of smoking gun in the record that says, wow, the joint results that we've developed with BASF under the agreement... That has spurred us on to draft claims in this particular manner, i.e. the patent B claims.
There is, in fact, a smoking gun, and I know I'm over my time, but I hope you permit me to answer the question. It's Dr. Singh's 2017 notebook. So this is the notebook that was put in front of the jury that
right.
Dr. Singh maintained at the time that he...
We're talking about the 2009 document?
We're talking about the 2009 document summarizing the results
right.
of the joint
and
evaluation.
So that's at A13244. And if you... I'm just, you know, just to let you know, it didn't jump out to me what in this summary document necessarily tells me that we're talking about patent B claims.
Yeah. I think for these purposes, recall that with respect to the patent B claim, the question is, of course, whether the jury had sufficient evidence on which to decide that the BASF construct was sufficiently incorporated into the patentee claim. So that's the standard. With respect to Dr. Singh's notebook...
Whether the what construct was incorporated into the patentee claim?
BASF's genes that were part of all of the 12 of the 13 constructs that the MTEA examined, and that Dr. Singh, and this is A1895, Appendix 9037-39, Dr. Singh acknowledged that that 2009 document was in his 2017 notebook because he was going back and referring to the results of the joint evaluation. I think that is more than plenty of evidence.
Did he acknowledge that that document is the same thing as the patent B claims?
I don't know that he acknowledged specifically that it was
did.
A patent B claim.
So that's the question I've got in my mind is, why are we looking at this document as being substantial evidence in the record that Singh relied on joint results in order to develop and draft the patentee claims?
So I think taking a step back and looking at what the patentee claims discuss, which are particular sequences containing BASF genes, and asking the question what the jury had in front of it, what the jury had was the MTEA that listed these constructs containing BASF genes. It had Dr. Singh's notebook, whether or not it said this pertains to patent B. They had Dr. Singh's notebook saying these are the results of the joint evaluation with BASF. That notebook was incorporated into his 2017 lab notebook that formed the basis for his patent applications. Those are the maps of the successful gene combinations that produce the joint results. We think that, again, is more than plenty to uphold that jury verdict on B. We think the same arguments go for at least two of the patents in Group A. And beyond that, the fact that the jury had in front of it evidence that it was BASF's process in canola that was, of course, the subject of this whole collaboration, I think means that for both Group A and Group D, ownership should have been found there as well. I'm aware I'm well over my time. If there are no further questions.
Do you want to pursue this further? Because I think that's a core issue.
No, I'm okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll save you rebuttal time, and we'll hear from Mr. Davis. You asked for... Proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Ed Davis on behalf of Cargill, specifically on the venue issue. May it please the court. The district court in this instance committed error when it found that venue existed over Cargill in the Eastern District of Virginia. The sole basis for the finding of venue as to Cargill was that the district court believed that Cargill and BASF were, in effect, partners and alter egos such that when BASF submitted the seeds to the ATCC in Manassas, that was sufficient to confer venue over Cargill. We think that was factually wrong, and we think that that was legally wrong, Your Honors. The court relied on this court's 1985 opinion in 3M versus Ecochem, but that was a decidedly different case. In that case, there was a party that actually was subject to a default judgment in another jurisdiction that dissolved and reformed itself in another state. And the district court in that case found, and this court affirmed, that in that particular instance, it was okay to reach through and find venue over another party.
Can I ask this question? I did not read in your brief an argument that the district court was wrong in saying that what BASF did, namely deposit seeds, was a use. I read only an argument that Cargill's not really responsible for that. Is that right?
I think that's fair, Judge Toronto.
So why even if piercing the corporate veil and corporate relations are one thing, why isn't being in business together enough to attribute to the two partners, which may be something, whether one uses that term as a legal matter or just as a descriptive matter, but both parties have a parallel interest in the acts that will positively serve the commercialization project. Why isn't that enough?
I think, Your Honor, that there may be certain circumstances in which that's enough. We would say here it's not enough, and I see my time is up. May I answer that question, Your Honor?
Please.
In this particular instance, the district court found that the deposit of the seeds at the ATCC effectively was a means towards monetizing the seeds. We would disagree with that. That was a means towards obtaining the patents for which BASF are the only named inventors and assignees. Cargill and BASF together could continue to monetize the seeds without ever having taken that step.
Wouldn't the monetization, I mean, I assume BASF wants a patent in order to make this crucial asset more valuable by protecting it against others. And if Cargill is a commercial partner in the exploitation of that, why doesn't it follow that Cargill is, you know, a direct beneficiary of that?
Because there's no guarantee that those partners would, that those patent applications would in fact protect the seeds. And what happened in this case is a very real example of that. Even though those applications were filed, Cargill and BASF nevertheless found themselves subject to what began as a 17-patent lawsuit, a counterclaim for infringement for those very same seeds.
And I'm sorry, the venue actually turns out to be a surprisingly substantial question in this case, not least because what we have not yet talked about, which is Home Depot. 1400B has remarkably parallel language to the language of 1441A, was it? That was the removal provision that was at issue in Home Depot, where the court said 5-4, but nevertheless, the court said, defendant means defendant. It doesn't mean counterclaim defendant.
That's right.
Why does Cargill have any 1400B rights at all?
I think the answer is that because although the language is similar, the Supreme Court has said in T.C. Heartland, and this court's cases in progeny have noted that decision was a sea change, and that in this particular instance.
Well, why isn't it right to say about that in particular? I think you rely on our language in Valiant. The language is the language. Pay attention to it. Rather than a matter of general policy, apart from the language, it says the language is the language. That seems more or less to be CSIRO's position here, not your position.
I agree, at least I understand that to be their position. I think the answer is the language doesn't always mean the language, and we saw that in T.C. Heartland, where the Supreme Court said that resides, for purposes of the general venue provision, doesn't mean what resides means for purposes of 1400B. And so in the instance of a patent-specific venue, while we acknowledge that Home Depot has some language that may bear on this instance, we think that it's distinguishable given that was related specifically to the Class Action Fairness Act, whereas this particular one deals with the patent venue statute. And in fact, what the majority opinion said, even in that 5-4 decision, was we acknowledge that this is a close call, and the reading that the dissent is giving the statute is a reasonable one. We just think that ours is better.
So in your view, a civil action for patent infringement means a claim for patent infringement?
I'm not sure that I would necessarily go that far, Your Honor.
Or
I think
it at least encompasses any claim for patent infringement.
I think that's probably right. I mean, the distinction here that we see is that...
But getting back to Judge Toronto's question, the Supreme Court in Home Depot rejected the idea that civil action, at least for purposes of that statute, could encompass a claim.
For purposes of that statute, in that situation, that's what the Supreme Court found.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis.
Mr. Davis?
Yes, Your Honor.
So just so I understand the end game, you want Cargill to get out of this case so that a lawsuit could be filed against Cargill somewhere else in the proper venue?
Well, I mean, we would certainly prefer that this court affirm for the that this court reverse for the reasons that Ms. Stetson stated, and so then there would be no other lawsuit to file. Ultimately, that would be a decision that CSIRO would have to make, but we do believe that because venue was not appropriate in the first instance, that what is appropriate here is that the judgment against Cargill be vacated.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Jay?
Would you mind starting with the venue question?
Be happy to, Your Honor. So our position on venue is that we did not file a civil action for patent infringement against Cargill. We brought counterclaims, and the Supreme Court said in Home Depot, in the identical procedural posture, a counterclaim by the original defendant in a forum picked by someone else, the original plaintiff, brought a counterclaim against the original plaintiff and others. And the Supreme Court said, that's not a new civil action. Neither is this. So that's our statutory argument. We also, of course, think the district court got it right, even if you apply 1400B to our counterclaim.
Is there something special about patent law, something unique about patent law, that where we have to read the patent-related statutes differently, like apparently what happened in D.C. Heartland?
We're certainly not arguing for that. We're actually arguing for
you. I know you're not arguing, but... Why can't what happened in D.C. Heartland be similar to what should happen here?
Well, a couple points about D.C. Heartland. One, it was interpreting the other prong of the statute, for one thing, the resides prong. Second, this court in HTC, post-D.C. Heartland case, explained the relationship of the patent venue statute and D.C. Heartland and other venue statutes, and it says that T.C. Heartland says that the patent venue statute applies when it applies, but that when there are no standards for venue, such as when the defendant is an alien, so there's no venue privilege, and so too here, there is no venue protection that applies to counterclaim defendants.
Was that HTC or ZTE?
I believe it's HTC,
okay. Okay.
I apologize, but that's what I have down.
So when looking at this, one of the cases that cropped up that people haven't talked about is an old 1932 Supreme Court decision, General Electric against Marvel. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that? It's the case that under Equity Rule 30 at the time said similar posture except no third party. That is. One, plaintiff sued defendant for a patent infringement, defendant counterclaimed against the plaintiff for patent infringement. One of the issues resolved by the Supreme Court, short opinion, was whether the plaintiff could say, no venue here under the predecessor of 1400B, and the Supreme Court said, now you're a plaintiff, you gave that up when you filed. But there's language in there suggesting might be, is as strong as one can say, that in general, it's not just the defendant, literally the defendant, who would have, I guess, 1400B rights than Judicial Code 48, that it was only the forfeiture that eliminated that. And if one takes that language, why doesn't that language suggest a rather strong policy to read what is now 1400B to say that in the absence of a forfeiture by voluntarily going to the forum, you're protected by in a patent case by the venue?
So I think that kind of built into your question is my answer that the Supreme Court, and I do recall reading that case, I believe that the Supreme Court chose to rest on waiver precisely because it was not willing to... A rationale like the one that you're positing would have eliminated the need to get to waiver holding at all, right? In other words, the court did not take up the question of what would happen to a third-party defendant. I think also...
There was none in that case, and at the time, third-party practice counterclaims essentially was a kernel of what it became with the federal civil rules.
And that's exactly where I was going, because that was under the equity rules. Then come the civil rules. And the author of the civil rules, Judge Clark of the Second Circuit, who wrote one of the decisions on which we rely, explained with some length, this is the 1944 decision of the Second Circuit.
Lesnick
versus public industry, that's right. Explained that where a party is brought in to the case after the civil action is commenced, the better reading is that they have no venue privilege, certainly not for a mandatory counterclaim defendant, because consider the position that the defendant is in. The defendant has to...
When you filed this counterclaim, did you designate, is it clear that this is a compulsory counterclaim, compulsory even from Cargill's point of view?
So that brings me actually to a point I wanted to make. So in patent cases uniquely, this is the one thing that is unique to patent cases here, is that there's a special joinder rule, 35 U.S.C. 299. Section 299 says that you can't join multiple infringers in the same case, whether as defendants.
Is this from the American Inventions Act provision, or did it precede that?
Amended in, I believe. That statute says that you can't join, whether as defendants or as counterclaim defendants, infringers in a single civil action, unless their conduct all arises from the same common nucleus of operative fact or the same transaction occurrence. That's the same test for counterclaims, for mandatory counterclaims. So I think it follows that if it weren't mandatory, we wouldn't have, it's in Title 35. If it weren't mandatory, we wouldn't be having this discussion. So I'd be happy to take any more questions about venue, but I do want to make sure to get to the other issues that we've raised.
So, I hope you don't mind if I circle back to venue sometime later.
Not at all. I'm here to answer the court's questions, and it certainly is an interesting issue. I think you may be right that I may have misspoken about ZTE versus HTC, as I look in my notes. But back to the one issue that really does cut across all of the patents is the correct interpretation of the MTEA, and I do want to turn to that. I took my friend's argument to be that because there are BASF genes in a couple of the patents, I believe I heard her say, those genes are joint results. That's not correct. That's not how the definitional provisions of the MTEA work. Genes that were included
maybe
by...
Maybe the genes themselves aren't joint results, but the work that was done that used those genes that yielded interesting results were... therefore stimulated the recognition that those genes were valuable genes that could be used in constructs that could then be claimed and patented. I think that's the line of thinking. And given all of the work that these two parties were doing together during the same critical time period, there was at least circumstantial evidence for the jury to conclude that, yes, all of that work, joint work done together that developed useful, interesting joint results, inspired the claims that ultimately got drafted.
So a couple of responses to that. One is a legal response about what the agreement provides for. The other is a factual response about what was proved at trial. So the agreement provides that intellectual property that subsists in joint results or joint new materials is co-owned. But there have to be actual joint results, or joint results is the information that derives from the collaboration. Joint new materials are actually developed in the collaboration. And this is the proof point, there has to be proof that the genes made their way into the patents, not because they were in the public domain, but as a result of the collaboration. That's where there's a complete failure of proof. Yet, to the contrary, the Group A patents in particular, these genes are listed in the specification of our provisional application, filed years before the collaboration began. So not only is there no circumstantial evidence that could sustain it, that could overturn a jury verdict, there's not even enough to sustain a jury verdict, suggesting that the collaboration inspired the Group A patents. And the same thing really is true for the Group B patents. And when in the colloquy with my friend in the first half of the argument, that you asked about whether there was a smoking gun, and the document found in the diary is the only thing that my friends on the other side have been able to point to. And as we say in our reply brief, that document does not say anything at all that suggests that the collaboration produced information that is now embodied in the Group B patent, or for that matter, any other patent. It's a summary of the of the collaboration. But
do we know from this 2009 document, again, JA 13244, there's these references to certain constructs, 1670, 1675. Do we know what those are?
So the performing constructs are the constructs that were listed on Schedule B as constructs that was going to be tested in the evaluation. None of those constructs is in any of the CSIRO patents. So just to be clear, that the other side is saying that genes that BASF came into the evaluation with, so they were listed on Schedule A as BASF's materials, old materials, not new materials, that because those genes showed up in the in a CSIRO patent, that BASF co-owns them. That's not correct as a matter of the language, because it fails to apply either joint new materials or joint results. And it's inconsistent with the jury instruction that the district court gave the jury at Appendix 8321, which says that there must be some joint results or joint new materials incorporated into the patents.
Is there any difference in your argument with respect to this agreement issue, the ownership issue, between, I guess, you are partly challenging a jury verdict and partly defending a jury verdict. Right, is there any difference in our thinking about those two applications of this ownership inquiry?
I don't think so, because our argument is that the jury was correctly instructed. No one's objected to the jury instruction. No one is here challenging the jury instruction or asking for a new trial. And so the question really is just whether there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find co-ownership of A, B, or D. And the jury found co-ownership only of B.
Could you remind me where in the JA the jury instruction is?
8321.
8321?
Yes. You'll see that that's not from the trial transcript, but I'll tell you that that is verbatim, with one, except for one letter, what the judge delivered to the jury. 83 is, that's volume four. And it says that if you find from a preponderance of the evidence that any such genetic materials, meaning jointly created new genetic materials, genetic lines or research results, were incorporated into any of the asserted patents, then BASF is a co-owner of such patent. That's the operative language. It's at the very bottom of 8321, carries over to 8322.
Written description. And in particular, tentacle.
So I think our response to that is that this is not the kind of case like the ones, including Centicor, on which my friends are relying, because in this case, the blueprint, no one is challenging possession of the blueprint. And the blueprint is where all the variability is. If we were here challenging possession of the blueprint, then maybe some of these other cases would be more analogous, where there are many variables and many things from which to choose. But this is implementation of the blueprint in a plant. And so throughout the specification, it says that the goal of this technology, and this is in the background of the invention, you know, right through the specification, is to develop it in crop plants, specifically oilseed crop plants. And I think really we have more than is required in that we have a working example, not required, which was reduced to practice, also not required. And there's testimony, expert testimony, from not just the inventor, Dr. Singh, but also our expert, Dr. Kunst, who said, if you have it in Arabidopsis, you have it in canola. The other side challenged Dr. Kunst and said, now, you know, Dr. Kunst, you know, this is a swearing contest between you and Dr. Murphy. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but saying that this is going to be a question whether the jury believes you or believes Dr. Murphy. Well, the jury believed Dr. Kunst and not Dr. Murphy.
But why did the jury believe your expert? Because just because your expert said, if you have it in Arabidopsis, then you have it in canola. What is the because?
Oh,
what is the why? Why do you necessarily have possession in canola?
So Dr. Kunst, who's worked with Arabidopsis for 35 years, explained that although there are some differences,
a lot of differences.
Sure, but not material ones, because number one, they're 85% genetically identical. Number two, they make oil in the same way, and that really is the key. Reason that they make oil in very similar ways. They have the same genetic ability to make ALA, which, as you know, is the fatty acid at the beginning of the pathway. So for those reasons, she explained, Arabidopsis is more convenient to work in the laboratory because its generations are quicker. It generates seeds and then a new plant much more quickly than if you had to go out and plant a canola crop and get the seeds from it and take the ones that are transgenic and develop and then plant them again and make a new generation. It's more convenient to work with, but definitely predictive. And I understand that the other side, their expert said, no, it's different sizes and it's different in all these ways. But that was a fact question for the jury about which whether it is similar in the relevant respects. And I think Dr. Kunst's explanation, this is at 10071 to 72 of the appendix, is very good on why Arabidopsis really is predictive. It's certainly enough for the on which the jury could base the verdict of adequate written description. And that's setting aside all of the disclosure of canola in the specification itself.
People were aiming at canola crop plant for a long time, and yet for some reason your side couldn't quite actually reduce it to practice for quite a few years, and the first couple times around it didn't work?
No, that's not right, Your Honor, and I'm glad to have the chance to address that. So the testimony is unrebutted that the very first time that CSIRO tried to implement it in canola, it did work. Why did they wait for a few years to implement it in canola? That's because they were optimizing it. And this goes back to the colloquy in the top side of the argument. The claims just deal with possession of a pathway in canola that can generate a small amount of oil, any amount of the oil. But the CSIRO scientists were working on optimizing the pathway so that it would be commercially viable. And they chose to do that in tobacco plants and other laboratory settings so that, this is Dr. Singh's testimony, when we did it in canola, it would work the first time. And that's exactly what happened. So,
am I misunderstanding or misremembering a quote from the record saying something like, okay, it didn't work?
So my friend pointed you to a document like that, but here I'd like appreciate the chance to explain that. So this, what we're talking about is a 2009 business case document from, I think Amanda
GRDC?
From GRDC, sorry, it's 2007, from GRDC. It is by business people, for business people, about whether they should invest $1 million in this project. And in the course of that document, they have a section on key risks. And unfortunately, the appendix does not include the page right before the quoted page, which is where the key risks header is. But you can see from that, from the testimony describing this document, that it goes on to discuss market risks, competition risks, technology risks, consumer regulatory engagement risks. All of these are written in the present tense, but they are all describing things that might happen, things that, if they did happen, would be bad and would make the investment risky. So, for example, on the first page, market won't accept a GM crop. That's obviously not talking about the market that day. It's talking about that is a hypothetical risk if we came to market. So the same thing is true of the possibility.
So each of the items is basically should be prefaced by the risk that.
Yes. That's right. It is a section called Key Risks, and that is exactly what it's describing. All of this is described by GRDC's institutional witness at trial, who also said that, that the risk they were focused on with respect to technology in particular was that it wouldn't produce commercial quantities in canola. And so the jury's entitled to credit all of that. Certainly this document does not suggest that there was not possession in the face of the expert evidence and the disclosure in the specification. I see that I'm over my time, and I've not
can we
been
go back to venue.
be happy to. I really would hope to discuss our cross appeal a little bit.
I want to talk about licenses too. But on venue, why can we say that these two, BASF and Cargill, were partners? I mean, the theory seems to be almost like for purposes of keeping Cargill in the case, we should just treat them as the same. And so almost like they're the same entity.
Well, so if
and
you...
so we don't even ask the question of whether they are a separate defendant or counterclaim.
We're not urging you to treat them as a single company, but we are saying that for purposes of their partnership here, the acts of one are attributed to the other, just as the court said in its en banc decision in Akabai. But I think the basis for that is the agreement itself, like the agreement between them, which has the division of responsibility. That's attached to a filing that it's not in the appendix, but attached to a filing in the district court at ECF 130. And this is going to be a long citation, but Exhibit 1 to that filing is the agreement, so you can see for yourself what they've agreed to do with each, you know, with, as respects each other. In Annex 1 to that agreement, and I believe it's page 37, they say they agree that, sorry, BASF will be responsible for filing patents on the canola, on Project Canola. So that basically is where this idea of a partnership comes from. And I think that the district court correctly recognized that that the two companies were working together. They didn't necessarily get each company sign off on each individual action, but that's exactly what joint infringement doesn't require, as the court said in Akamai. When you have two companies working together or two infringers working together, then within the scope of their partnership, the acts of one are attributed to the other. I think it's as simple as that for
a while. So to agree with the court below, we have to borrow from Akamai and think of this as an Akamai situation?
I think whether you see it as inducement or joint infringement, that...
I mean, what I'm troubled by is I'm trying to figure out how would I write an opinion that says, yeah, this is fine. We can just slap these two people together and call them a partnership and move on.
I mean, in any venue case in which you're relying on the has committed acts of infringement in the district, you're necessarily going to be relying on somewhat incomplete allegations because it necessarily comes up at the Rule 12 stage before there's been a ton of discovery, before everything has been hashed out, and you're not making a final binding decision of infringement that they are responsible for each other's actions definitively, but you are... in a case where 1400B applies and you're relying on that prong of it, you are saying that it's good enough for venue purposes that the claimant has alleged that they have committed, that they are jointly responsible. And I think that really is sufficient here. That, I mean, as just
was the Akamai standard itself invoked in the district court, either by or the district court or to the district court?
Well, I mean, the district court referred to it as a matter of partnership, but I think that he did not suggest that that's a matter of the agreement characterizing itself as a partnership. I mean, to the contrary, he said that the agreement doesn't characterize itself as a partnership, but that doesn't matter.
It, right?
Yes, but he says that doesn't matter for purposes of whether one is responsible for the actions of the other. And while he didn't cite Akamai, I took this to be, you know, in substance the same thing, that Akamai, as you know, relies on the restatement of torts and the principles of that apply to joint tortfeasors, because one is, for everything they do within the scope of their partnership, one is the agent of the other. I took that to be what he's saying.
All right, so let's hear from the other side. We'll save your rebuttal. These are complex issues that we're getting into. Ms. Jensen.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple quick points, one on written description, one on ownership. First, with respect to Centocor, I think the distinction that Mr. Jay drew for you, Judge Toronto, that involved a antibody and this involved a blueprint, isn't quite right. You know, the claims in Centocor had to do with an antibody, but the process that was described in the specification was a blueprint for a human antibody. And what the court found there was that was not sufficient. That was not substantial evidence supporting a written description. What Mr. Jay didn't talk about as well is Boston Scientific from 2011, this court's Ariad en banc decision from 2010, Purdue Pharma from 2000. All of those actually involve the types of discussions and specifications that we're talking about, where you have a passing mention of a claim or of a particular set of projects that are within a particular range, but there is no indication that there is anything special about that particular passing mention that makes its way into the actual patent claim. There is simply not enough
to constitute a written description, just as in Centocor, just as in Ariad, just as in Pin-Nip, which is another case where this court withdrew a reversal of a judgment of a matter of law denial. All of those are in exactly the same posture this is. This is not new to this court. With respect to ownership, Mr. Jay took issue with the smoking gun I offered. I'll offer two more. The first is with respect to Dr. Singh's own testimony, Appendix 8995 to 8996, Dr. Singh admits that the B patent, the patent that Sosiro is challenging, incorporated, quote, results generated in 2008-2009, which was the time that this, after this collaboration was complete. The other smoking gun I would point you to is Appendix 12308. And this is the 2009 progress report. And one of the things the progress report talks about is that the first generation construct that they tried didn't detect the presence of any long-chain fatty acids. But then they go on, and they say, disappointing result, but then it allowed us to identify and remove some bottlenecks. In 2008, we tested both single and dual EPA-DHA construct strategies. These constructs contain various combinations of Sosiro plus international collaborator genes. And those constructs are what resulted in the good results that led to the patents as we understand them. So with respect to the constructs and the ownership, I think it's clear from Sosiro's own, or GRDC's, own discussion, that these constructs, these genes that were incorporated into the patent, form the basis of the joint results that we're talking about.
Can we talk about the exclusion of certain licenses in the royalty analysis?
Certainly, yes.
I guess I'm concerned about that choice by the judge below to exclude those partnership agreements and yet permit and allow into the record other partnership agreements. It feels inconsistent. Can you?
Yes, I think that there's one misunderstanding, perhaps, when we talk about excluding the licenses. No license was excluded. The district judge, in his discretion, considered the license that I think you're referencing, Judge Chen, which was the license between the joint partnership of NuSeed and Sosiro and GRDC. He considered that license. He didn't exclude it.
So what if I were to read the record as him having excluded it?
I don't want to resist your question, but I don't think you can read the record as him having excluded it. I think what he did is consider that license and say, this license isn't sufficiently comparable, in my view. And remember, this court has said with respect to royalties, this is not an exact science. So what the judge said was, this isn't sufficiently comparable. This is a complicated, not arm's length agreement among a number of business partners. So I'm going to declare that not sufficiently comparable. The expert that offered the three licenses for BASF, he found more persuasive and credible, but even those licenses he didn't find immediately on point, completely comparable. He took those licenses that Mr. Knapper offered, the expert that he found more credible, and concluded that with respect to those licenses, there were differences between this case and those that warranted some upward adjustments in what Mr. Knapper had recommended, upward adjustments both from the royalty rate and from the lump sum payment. So he adjusted it up from 1-point-something% to 3-point-something%.
So then you're saying the right way to look at what happened below is the judge did allow in and consider the NuSeed agreement, the Cargill agreement, but just found them a little too remote and to be actually factored into the royalty rate?
I think, yes. I think there's a significant...
Obviously, they weren't actually considered and worked into the royalty analysis in the end, right?
Right. I think the judge's royalty analysis, again, brought in a number of different factors, including some upward adjustments that he made. Upward adjustments he made in light of the jury verdict.
I understand what he did with the other licenses. I'm just focused right now on these two.
So I think the best way to say it, Judge Chen, is that there is a difference between excluding and considering and rejecting.
And the district judge, as district judges do all the time, with evidence that's proffered about royalties, considered the Nuseed Cicero GRDC agreement and decided that that non-arm's length agreement, which, by the way, doesn't even trigger the kind of astronomical royalties we're talking about until $46 million in net sales is met. So you know, that alone, I think, describes why the judge might not have otherwise accepted it. But he considered it. He rejected it. He looked at other comparators. He decided those weren't quite right either. And then he made a series of decisions about adjusting up or down based on his assessment of all of the evidence and testimony that he heard in front of him. And we think he landed in a reasonable place. Happy to answer
Thank
any
you.
Other questions on
that. Thank you, Ms. Stetson.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis, you have 1 minute for your cross-appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, as far as I'm aware, there was no discussion for the district court or in the briefing at all about Akamai and its applicability to this particular instance. We don't believe that there's any applicability to Akamai here, specifically as it relates to the allegation that BASF and Cargill were partners. The district court didn't specifically make any finding other than to just state on the record that he believed them to be partners. More importantly, I think in response to Judge Toronto's question when I was before Your Honors the first time, you asked about particular instances in which parties could be charged with the actions of another, and I would just point to this court's decision in Valiant from last November. Obviously, that's a slightly different context because it's a Hatch-Waxman situation, but that was an instance in which the defendants were actually related entities. They were all Mylan entities. One was responsible for filing the Hatch-Waxman.
I wonder if that actually it's easier to find, perhaps, that separate corporations, as long as their forms are being respected, are not to be collapsed into one, then it may be if two corporations, whatever their ownership relationships, are actually in business together. So,
it may be, Your Honor. Again, I think that exists along a continuum, and the court would need to look at the facts, but I point to the Valiant case as an example in which this court concluded that even though there were three closely related entities, the venue finding was proper as to one, but not as to the other two. And there are vehicles that all of the parties and their able counsel knew about what you could do. In the instance in this case, in which the third party counterclaim was filed against both BASF and Cargill, what Zyro could have done was to file a separate lawsuit in a jurisdiction and venue in which personal jurisdiction and venue against Cargill was proper, and then seek an MDL or some other provision to make that happen. That didn't happen here, and we think that was error. And we think, as a result, the venue finding should be reversed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Sorry.
And Mr. Jay, you have the last word on your cross-appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. And Judge Toronto, it was HTC after all at page 1357. I'm sorry about that. So a couple of responses to the second and third smoking weapons that my friend attempted to deploy. I think we've responded to each of those in the briefing. The first of them at page 10 of our gray brief, which is about the results generated in 2008, 2009. It's exactly the point. The collaboration results didn't come in until later in 2009, when we'd already filed for the Group B patent. Other one had to do with the failure of a construct, but there's a lot of testimony both from Dr. Singh and his colleague, Dr. Petrie, that CSIRO had what they called plans B and C, which were other attempts to do this research, but not with the original blueprint. And so at pages 35 to 36 of our red brief, We give you the citations for why that is not evidence of the failure of the original construct, the Delta 6 pathway that winds up in the patents in canola.
What was the point you made about the very first thing, the 2008-2009, not the other construct thing?
Right. So, my friend quoted from an email about results generated in 2000, Dr. Singh's statement about results generated in 2008-2009. The citations are at page 10 of our gray brief, that the timing for that argument doesn't work because the results that he's talking about, which are in the Group B patent, predate the completion of the evaluation. And that certainly there's no, so at most there's a timing coincidence that the evaluation is going on, but the evaluation hasn't even concluded, and there's no evidence that anything from the evaluation actually makes its way into these patents. Nothing, not even that the jury could make that decision based on. On remedy, of course, one of our points is that the judge should not have been making this decision at all, that it should have gone to the jury on at least the past damages. But certainly on the comparability point, if it was going to remain with the judge, the agreements that he relied on were similarly situated to the agreement that he refused to rely on, in that they were not fair licenses, they were collaboration agreements, or that they had something mutual. So the judge's reasoning doesn't hold up on its own terms. That's enough, I think, to conclude that it's an abuse of discretion. And of course, our primary point on remedy has been that if you reinstate the Group B patent, you would need new proceedings on remedy in any event, so you might not need to reach that issue. Although I do think you would need to reach the question of who the fact finder would be in the first instance on remedy.
Is there any link in this case between the venue question and the remedy question if we were to conclude that Cargill needs to be dismissed? What effect, if any, would that have on any of the other questions, but I'm thinking particularly about remedy?
Certainly, if there were going to be new proceedings on remedy, that could be addressed there. But I don't think that it would change either the need for an injunction or the evidence on which you would rely for a properly computed royalty before the jury. So, in other words, if Cargill were let out of the case, I don't think that would be a basis for setting aside any of the work that's been done. But, of course, we're appealing a number of errors in it. Pardon?
Right. You want to add to what the remedy you've got?
Yeah. The only thing I can think of that's different is that on willfulness, the judge relied in part on the notion that BASF came into court and sought a declaratory judgment. And, of course, Cargill did not do that. And so if Cargill were out of the case, one of our criticisms of that reasoning would be taken away, and that criticism is that doesn't apply to Cargill. We have other criticisms of that reasoning, but I think that's the only Cargill-specific thing I can think of for the remedy. But ultimately, Cargill has never really grappled with the statutory language. It explained why it was that we filed a civil action for patent infringement, brought a civil action for patent infringement against them. We brought a counterclaim and added them to the case, and I think that means that this is not a venue, a case where the venue statute applies at all.
Okay.
Unless the press has other questions.
Anything else? Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.